the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. I have to say it's been a while since I opened with music from Weird Al Yankovic. Today, an in-depth interview and a warm and fun conversation with my friend, journalism professor Peter Laufer. His brand new book is called Organic, A Journalist's Quest to Discover the Truth Behind Food Labeling. And he traveled the world to Kazakhstan and to Bolivia to track down organic products that he bought here in the United States and to find out if they truly were grown in an organic manner. It's a fascinating story. We take a look at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, its promotion of organic products, and the very limited enforcement operation they have against people who abuse the labeling rules. I couldn't do this without your support. Subscribers like Eric Boll, who just renewed his annual subscription, Casita, Aminya, I hope I pronounced your name right, Bernice Del Orto, Linda Gray, they're just some of the people who support me here. I invite you to join them if you put down that organic food long enough to come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on the sign-up link. It's right under my mugshot on the homepage. And there you get to choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever you're comfortable with. Our best deal is that $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers from anywhere within the sound of my voice get a bonus gift. It's an ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's newest, called Empire of Chaos. Have a banana, have a whole bunch. It doesn't matter what you had for lunch. Just eat it, eat it, eat it, eat it. Eat it, eat it, eat it, eat it. Our opening music today from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. The song is called Organic Anti-Beatbox Band. And are they really organic? Who certified the Red Hot Chili Peppers as organic? And can they actually claim that they are the organic anti-beatbox band? We're not going to answer that question today, but we're going to look at similar questions. Peter Laufer returns to our program, and you should know he's a longtime friend and colleague and co-conspirator of mine. Most recently, he invited me to the University of Oregon, where he's a journalism professor, to conduct a workshop on podcasting. And I had a great time. It was really fabulous to be back on a college campus, Peter, and you get to do that every day.
Hey, I'm doing it right now, Peter. I'm looking out at the grove of evergreen trees on the other side of the window from my office. The university was founded in 1876, and sometime not that long after that, somebody had the bright idea to plant an example evergreen from each of the species that we have here in Oregon. And now I am blessed to have this array of trees out there on the green. And it looks a little incongruous because we don't usually see these different species together. And at the same time, it maybe, if I can push some sort of metaphor here, it is emblematic of the cross-disciplinary nature of the campus, which you felt here and we really feel every day. It is such a privilege to be in this mix of ideas, in this think tank. So when you write that check to the State Board of Equalization and that inconsequential percentage goes to support the University of California and the state university system and the junior colleges, I know you don't mind.
Nope, I don't. I know we need to spend more, and
exactly.
It's sad to see the way we have been cutting back on our investment in public higher education during the recent economic difficulties, and much of that has not been restored. But I want to just briefly note that when I came to your campus in Eugene, you were kind enough to host me, and we conducted this workshop. And then over lunch, we learned that there was a guest lecturer in from Canada, Bart Beatty, who was going to talk about the Charlie Hebdo incident and those cartoons. And sitting in the classroom as he gave that guest lecture really brought back to me the real thrill of being on a college campus and the exchange of ideas. And I want you to know I had a great podcast interview with Professor Beatty and got great response from listeners from that. So it was something that, gave me in exchange for what I was able to offer to some of your students, and also provided some fodder for a great podcast. So it was a win-win-win proposition, Professor.
Well, it's great to hear that. And I just have to alert you that you'll be facing some competition because of the success of your work up here and on the podcast workshops, both here at the Eugene main campus and up at our campus in Portland. Several students and some faculty are plotting and planning their own podcasts. That universe is filling up, and what I, before we talk about anything else, if you have one more minute here to muse, how do you see that as somebody who relatively early on has entered this arena? How much more content, more product can it handle without the audience being so diffused that there are only a couple of us listening to each?
Well, it's different. There's just no question that the media landscape has changed and we need to adapt to it. I welcome new voices into podcasting. It's a more the merrier mentality from my point of view. And I believe that what I offer will, in any ultimate shakeout, find an audience. So I don't really fear the competitive aspect of it. There is the problem of just too much content out there. And, for example, if you go to Stitcher or if you go to the podcast section at iTunes, it can be overwhelming. And as I pointed out in the workshop, that's where the search mechanisms really become powerful tools for listeners to find the content that appeals most to them. Now, that all works in many respects, but the loss is in public dialogue. Because when people search for content, they don't necessarily search for conflicting views, for other aspects or other perspectives on a given topic. And so, the situation I see in the country right now, Peter, where we have a major constitutional crisis, where nearly half of the United States Senate is actively working to undermine the diplomacy of the president by contacting and, essentially scuttling talks with a foreign power. And I see this as a product of our bifurcated media. And those who, think that they are standing up to a bad deal, in my view, are actually putting the interests of the state of Israel before the interests of the United States of America. And I believe that this is largely driven by the split in the media in this country and the way those 47 senators who signed the letter to the Ayatollah are playing to the chorus at Fox News.
And yet at the same time, knowing you as I do, I cannot imagine that you would favor any kind of control that would prevent this diffusion that's occurred so that we don't just have three television channels and a couple of daily newspapers and a handful of radio stations for our media outlets.
No, not at all. I don't believe in control. And I think that, you know, we need to educate the listeners, the users of this content that we generate, to be skeptical and to be, you know, looking for points of view and sources of information that they might not be fully comfortable with. And the biggest problem I see in media today is everybody's getting into a comfort zone. You know, the couch potato is kind of a permanent position now for far too many Americans.
That's why I listen to Rush Limbaugh on my way down to work when I don't take my bicycle.
Well, I listen to those people too. And
yeah, luckily, it's only a 5-minute commute for me, so I don't have to listen to them very long.
Peter Laufer, your new book is called Organic, A Journalist's Quest to Discover the Truth Behind Food Labeling, and the book starts in your kitchen. And you have long been someone who I have known to be a vegetarian, somebody who is very careful about the food that you eat, and it's clear that you actually read the food labels on the products that you purchase and consume. So tell our listeners about a bag of nuts and a can of beans that drove you to travel the world to explore the meaning of the term organic and whether consumers are being misled, at least at times.
It all started, Peter, at the Trader Joe's across the river here in Eugene on Coburg Road, where my wife Sheila bought and brought home a bag of walnuts, and they turned out to be rancid, and these things happen. I'm sure plenty of your listeners shop at Trader Joe's, and they have a terrific return policy. You don't have to bring back something that's spoiled to get your money back. If you just don't like the taste of it, and it's perfectly fine, they'll give you your money back. So I took the bag of walnuts back to Trader Joe's. Now, Sheila takes all of this one step further and tends to double our grocery bill by buying stuff that's labeled organic, and I don't fight it because she's in charge of the kitchen, and it's good she is because she's a great cook. And I brought these walnuts back to Trader Joe's and talked to the manager. He probably was one of our students, this collegiate-looking guy with a nice smile, one of the team there that they call the crew, I believe, at Trader Joe's in their Hawaiian shirts with the 50s, 60s rock and roll cranked up loud so that you can dance through the aisles as you pick up their private label products. And he and I looked at the bag, and it was see-through cellophane. We could tell they were indeed walnuts. And then we looked closer, and they said organic walnuts. And just we were bantering back and forth, and we saw it said product of Kazakhstan.
Kazakhstan.
At that point, yes. At that point, he and I exchanged what I guess we would refer to as titters, and laughed about the likelihood of anything coming from Kazakhstan being whatever it says it is, if it is something that would need to be special like organic. And our arrogance, perhaps our prejudice, is not inappropriate. That superficial sense that Kazakhstan is perhaps not a Garden of Eden of organic products, as my research continued for the project, played true. Kazakhstan is, its government and its businesses are right there at the top. If you're looking
the dictator repression scale?
Yeah, I was trying to come up with something clever, and that'll serve just fine. The corruptometer, perhaps.
All right.
And it's just an extraordinary corrupt society, which is fueled by extraordinary oil wealth. And so we laughed about this. He gave me my money back. I didn't think about it anymore. And then a couple of weeks later, Peter, Sheila was on the line on an 800 number to a company that provided us with a can of so-called organic black beans. And she wanted to know particularly if the can was lined with BPA, which that's the abbreviation for a substance that is used in can linings and apparently is not too good for your health. So the woman at the other end of the line said to her, just look at the top of the can, and that will tell us where it was produced, and then I can tell you what the can has inside. And she looked at the top of the can, and there in blue lettering it said product of Bolivia. I happened to be sitting across from her at the dining room table while this conversation was going on, and that piqued my interest because as a journalist, I've done a lot of work in Bolivia, particularly around cocaine trade, and I know that if there is a place that is competitive with Kazakhstan on the corruptometer, that's got to be Bolivia. So that was the genesis of this project. And I decided, Peter, that what I wanted to do was have a better comfort zone, so to speak, about spending all this extra money on stuff called organic and find out what that label meant. And I decided to start by tracking back these two products. I wanted to find the orchard where those walnuts were grown, and I wanted to find the bean field where those beans were grown and talk to the farmers.
And Peter, let's be honest here. You love to travel, and this was an excuse to scratch your itch to go back to Bolivia and to visit Kazakhstan.
Well, you do know me well, Peter, but also on the Amazon page for this book, there's some caustic guy that I keep doing everything I can not to write back to who trashes the book in his review. And I always love these anonymous reviewers who sit around addled in their basements and try to destroy careers. But this particular guy says, clearly, I have not much interest in studying organic food. What I want to do is travel and write off the travel on my tax return.
Right. So let's start here in the United States. Who designates what is or is not organic? How is that defined? And is there any enforcement mechanism for someone who might abuse the term organic in marketing a consumer food product?
Yeah, it all goes back in its current incarnation to the late 60s, early 70s, Peter, when there became a maybe out of the counterculture, one could argue, an interest in so-called organic food, defined arbitrarily as not having pesticides or herbicides on it during its development, and other criteria that were added to that. And it was established by the producer, the farmer, or whomever created the food product, if it was something like crackers or whatever else it was that had multiple products in it. And then there would be some sense of comfort by the consumer who felt that the retailer was paying attention to this or that the producer, the farmer, was doing a good job. That became codified in the late 90s by the U.S. Department of Agriculture when the National Organic Program became part of the marketing arm of the USDA. And it's important to note that it's part of the marketing arm because the USDA does a lot of things, and a lot of what the USDA does is go out into the world marketplace and promote American agriculture. So this was part of that marketing arm, and a structure was put in place defining organic legally. This miffed some in the organic area who believe that, in fact, the standards put out by the USDA are inadequate, that they are compromised. But be that as it may be, the National Organic Program was established, and therefrom comes that familiar green sticker that most of us know now that says USDA Organic on the food labels that we buy. Now, there's a lot of money. In the last 20 years, the organic sector, the amount of money that we American consumers spend on organics, has gone from about $2 billion a year to $35 billion a year. It's
wow.
An extraordinary curve, just an extraordinary curve. And the businesses can't keep up with the demand. And I always have a hard time with this number. It's so extraordinary. It was $27 billion just a couple of years ago when I was doing the research at the USDA, and it's gone up to $35 billion now. At the time, there was one USDA National Organic Program, not inspector, but employee for every $1 billion of that $27 billion. So just a few inspectors. That to your overall question about enforcement. There are dedicated people working, public servants at the USDA in the National Organic Program, but they can't even come close to handling the complaints that they get. And that said, they are not in charge of the inspections. I should take a breath here so that you keep me on track. But what happens next in this story is an analysis of how the inspections and certification take place.
So why don't you next introduce our listeners to Miles McAvoy and talk a little bit about what he attempts to do with a skeleton staff and with a mandate to promote the sale of products rather than enforce rules to make sure that the organic label is credible and honestly used.
Yeah, and maybe his mandate is to do both, but he definitely is in the promotion business. And the Farm Bill, the most recently passed Farm Bill, has shoved some more money over to the National Organic Program so that there will be a little bit more money for enforcement. But his job in a tidy little office, and little is an important part of that description, in the USDA headquarters in Washington, his office is in charge of trying to keep track of what's going on in the organic sector. Now, you're familiar with Marin County, just north of San Francisco, Peter, and Marin County is a hotbed of stores that sell this sort of stuff and consumers mm-hmm. with very fat wallets ready to buy it. Do you know, I ask you, and we haven't had this conversation off the air, do you know where most of that organic grocery money is spent? In Marin County, hipster Marin County, where the rents cost more than probably the county budgets in most of Georgia.
Well, I'm going to guess Costco.
Because, and you are right.
Because I don't shop there only because of the quantities that they sell and that Kathy and I can't consume those quantities. And so we stay away from Costco, fearing that we will overshop and submit to impulse opportunities. But everybody I know shops at Costco, and I know that they have made a big effort to feature organic foods.
As has Walmart, and there's nothing wrong with that, of course. And in fact, one can argue, and plenty in the organic sector do argue, that this is a good thing, and it's exposing some consumers who would not otherwise necessarily consider making this dietary change to organic products, or at least products labeled organic. And that brings us back to the certification process. So here in America, where we pride ourselves apparently on the private sector doing the work of the army and all sorts of other things, we have decided that the private sector is going to be in charge of certifying what is in fact organic according to USDA set standards.
Well, I like that. You know, self-regulation was very effective on Wall Street. It's just set new standards in the regulation of nuclear power plants. Really, self-regulation by industries just makes a lot of sense.
Well, to feed your cynicism, we can just add the fact that not only is the private sector in charge of the certification process, of course, to USDA standards, but those being certified, the farms, the processors being certified, pay for the certification. So you have a competitive marketplace with multiple players seeking the contracts for certification, and they are paid by those they are certifying.
I've got no problem with that. You know, the agencies that rated the mortgage packages for Wall Street, they were paid a fee by the Wall Street banks to make sure that their trash was rated AAA. It all works for me, Peter.
So I suppose a guy like you would like the Internal Affairs Department of the Ferguson Police Department to conduct any investigations of seeming impropriety by a Ferguson police officer.
Well, the FBI is permitted to investigate its own agents who kill suspects while they're in custody and has exonerated every agent who has ever been investigated. I'm going to stop now, Peter.
Okay, we'll both stop. But there is obviously the potential for conflicts of interest when the certifying company is being paid by those they certify. Would they have a tendency to not be as rigorous, as arduous? I'm not suggesting that that is the case, but as I traveled the world, I saw other systems in place that would give me more confidence as a consumer. The other problem is that there is so much to certify as this sector grows exponentially that the certifying agencies are stretched. The certifying agencies, as I mentioned, are operating to USDA standards. They have to be essentially licensed by the USDA. But there are those who not only are concerned about the appropriateness of the USDA standards, but they are concerned that the USDA itself is polluted by too much industry deciding what constitutes organic. And some of your listeners may be surprised to learn that there are 200 some odd substances that can be in a product labeled USDA organic and are not organic. The USDA organic stamped on the product means that 95% of what's in there is organic. And if it doesn't have that stamp on it, if it says made with organic corn, for example, and it's corn chips, that does not mean that the whole product is organic, although you may tend to believe that that's what it means. It means that 70% of it is organic. And corn chips are a good example because the corn could be organic, but the bath of oil is not organic oil. It costs a lot to go back and forth transferring the organic and the conventional, so-called conventional oils. And so it's easy to put the organic corn in a bath of conventional oil. If that bothers you as a consumer, that could be of concern regarding labeling. Maybe it doesn't bother you as a consumer. But that brings up one more point, and then I'll take another breath, Peter, and that is when a company or a farm or any entity in this chain of farm to fork is bifurcated itself, doing both conventional and organic food work, then the issue also is complicated by how good a job are they doing keeping those separate.
Yeah. And you quote Miles McAvoy, again, the guy who runs the organic program at the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And a dedicated public servant, a really nice guy.
He talks about the beauty of his system. It's actually the envy of the world. In Europe, they have a much less transparent process in terms of how they develop the organic standards, and there's a lot of complaints that there's not enough access by the organic community in terms of development of the standards. If you compare the standards of Europe and the U.S. has much stronger standards in terms of organics, and so our process is, I guess, working in terms of making sure that the standards are very strict. He goes on to cite that antibiotics are an example, saying that they're prohibited in USDA-approved organic livestock in the U.S. and only restricted in the European Union. Pesticide restrictions are tighter, he says, in the United States than they are across the Atlantic. Are his assertions borne out by your research, for example, in Austria?
Well, certainly not from my conclusions, and that's not to say what he's saying isn't true in terms of his interpretation of what he cites there. But for transparency, what I faced just picking these two serendipitous items, the black beans and the walnuts, what I faced were slam doors. The fact that I eventually did find Pedro, the bean farmer, out in Bolivia is, I say with a certain amount of self-congratulations, due to my tenacity, but certainly not due to any transparency, government or industry. And the fact that I determined that the walnuts were not, in fact, from Kazakhstan, was not to do with any overt help from government, and nothing but subversion by industry to keep me from finding that out. By contrast,
Wait a minute. That's a very important point there. I don't want to gloss over it. Trader Joe's initially appeared to be consumer friendly in answering your questions about where those walnuts came from. And once they got wind that you were fairly serious about this, they adopted Pentagon PR tactics and basically not only declared it trade secrets and stonewalled in that manner, but essentially the USDA backed them up. And while their process ultimately did affirm that the walnuts from Kazakhstan could not be organic, there was no penalty in this process for Trader Joe's for selling some number of packages falsely labeled to their consumers.
Mahalo, as Trader Joe's said to me, as they adopt their Hawaiian greeting, despite the fact that they're owned by Aldi, a German conglomerate of supermarkets with a similar closed-door policy for prying reporters and professors. And so I guess I'm a combination of those two bad worlds for them. I don't guess, I know. And yes, as you outline it, that is correct. They initially said, yeah, don't worry about a thing. These things are good for you. And then when I told them what I was doing and that I wanted to join them on a buy with their purveyor, whatever that's called, the guy who's in charge for Trader Joe's to go out and find the products, it wasn't just a slam door. It was just go away. Don't bother us. We want nothing to do with you, and we will have nothing to do with you. And I learned very quickly that this is Trader Joe's policy. Trader Joe's has that come on in the stores, which is so inviting and so delightful. It's really fun to shop there. And right behind that facade is we will tell you absolutely nothing about our operation. Don't even try. Don't bother us. We're not going to answer your letter. We're not going to answer your telephone call. And if you come to our corporate headquarters, as I did down in Southern California, it is unmarked. And it's not just unmarked, but it has a nice sign up there saying if you come knock on the door, you'll be considered a trespasser. And you will be prosecuted.
That's really friendly.
It's really, really friendly. I'm kind of frothing at the mouth just thinking about it again. And so, what was your question?
Well, the next stage of it was that you went through the process and you filed an official complaint with the Organic Division of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And tell us how that process went forward.
Yeah, the National Organic Program. I was told, I filed the initial complaint as a consumer, and I was told basically, tough luck, Charlie. We get too many requests for investigations. We don't have the manpower for it. And so go away. Very nicely said. There's no question. Unlike Trader Joe's, very nicely said from the government. So I wrote back and did what you've done so many times, Peter, and it's so offensive on some level. It's like getting into Disneyland free because you're a reporter. And so on one level, isn't that fun? You don't have to pay for those e-tickets or whatever they're called these days. And on another level, isn't it offensive when you see the great unwashed standing in line ready to pull off crisp 20s? And I wrote to the USDA in my capacity as a professor here at the university and an investigative reporter, and suddenly they said, oh, and I told them some of what I had already learned, and they said, oh, yeah, well, I guess we will launch an investigation after all.
Well, but you had to resend your email in the form of an official complaint. They wouldn't process it simply as a report of your findings. You had to get bureaucratic about it. And then what was the process and what was their ultimate finding?
Their ultimate finding was that, in fact, these were not organic walnuts from Kazakhstan. And my then further requests, well, then where are they from? Are they, in fact, organic? How is it that Trader Joe's is labeling them organic and from Kazakhstan? How did they get past the certification system from the private certifying company? What are you going to do about this? Will there be a penalty for the certifying company? Will there be a penalty for Trader Joe's? Will consumers be alerted who bought these, double the price and under the impression they were organic? And all of those questions were left unanswered. So at that point, I filed a Freedom of Information Act request to get those questions answered. And I'm looking at the folder now, Peter, and that process is pretty much done. We're appealing the FOIA because of the fact that the pages are redacted to silliness and the questions are not answered. All of this under the guise of we as the USDA, as your representative in government, the regulatory agency, cannot interfere with what we have accepted as what Trader Joe's calls business secrets. And so the orchard in Kazakhstan, where these walnuts apparently came from, is so important to keep private so that Trader Joe's doesn't lose any market share to Costco or Walmart or wherever, because Walmart might come in and pay a penny less for the walnuts or whatever they supposedly are claiming that they're concerned about. It's a business secret, and you don't have any right to know as an American consumer.
And this is like so many things that are considered, secret or top secret. Often our government protects things to protect people from embarrassment, not to protect sensitive information. And,
well, also,
and
in this case, Peter, it is overtly stated. We are protecting the business interests, and we, the United States Department of Agriculture, determine that those business interests supersede your interests as a consumer. And this is not something like what kind of chair you're going to buy for your living room. This is what you eat. And if you subscribe to the old chestnut, you are what you eat, then your government is telling you it's none of your business what you are.
And when, you know, we think about the limited number of regulators and the number of possible complaints that they could receive every year, is it by design that Congress doesn't fund more investigators in this Office of Organic Promotion, that's my name for it, at the Department of Agriculture?
Yeah, I don't take it quite that far. I think that everything's just growing so fast, but it certainly isn't a priority. It absolutely is not a priority. There's a real sense, as the McAvoy quote you read earlier suggests, that everything's working fine and we should be lucky that we have such a system in place. Now, one could argue that that's something to consider, because there is enough regulation in the organic sector that it makes the so-called conventional sector look somewhat ignored. That doesn't mean that we're handling this properly, though. This is what we eat. And when both the businesses that provide it to your market and your government that is the overseer is telling you it is none of your business and you can't know this because we don't want to lose a competitive edge because we are in business, that just seems skewed. But, of course, the business of America is business.
Now, Peter, earlier you touched on the fact that it is the producers of organic products who pay Quality Assurance International to certify their products as organic. And this appears to be incestuous and insidious. And I'm reminded that for years in this country, we had an agency called Underwriters Laboratories. And this was a group that was funded by General Electric and other manufacturers in the country. And when they produced a new appliance, a toaster oven or a lamp or anything like that that would go into our homes, they would send it and a UL would put their little sticker on it. And we did come to rely on Underwriters Laboratories as a neutral arbiter, there to protect public safety from potentially dangerous appliances or products. How would you compare QAI to UL?
Well, QAI, Quality Assurance International, which is the major player in the private sector of certifiers, they have about 60% of the market share, is another one of these operations with doors slammed. And you've got business poking around there, according to them. And I requested of QAI the opportunity to learn more about them, and they offered no executives for me to chat with. And I also requested to go with them on inspections in order to be able to answer that question that you just asked. And they told me to go take a hike in nice corporate language. Now, if any of your listeners are considering becoming news reporters, here's a fun trick, which I was successful at employing, and you can read the results in the book, that I just poked around a little bit. Who are the players? Who works for QAI? Who's been there for a long time? And I found a guy, and this was it's perhaps not as much my gumshoe work as just dumb luck, but that's often journalism. And I found a guy who had retired as a top executive at QAI just a couple of weeks before I started getting the door slammed in my face. And guys who are type A personalities and have worked in industry for 30, 35 years and suddenly are sitting on the floor in front of the TV playing with their grandkids can get pretty antsy after a couple of weeks of retirement. And I had a delightful conversation with this fellow that is quoted at length in the book and learned a lot about the processes of QAI, but not because of any transparency at the certifying organization or its government overseers.
Mm-hmm. Well, Peter, I highly recommend your book to our listeners. They know my bias and that I've known you for a long time. But you really deliver. You write in a colorful style. You take us with you as you travel the globe, tracking down this information, providing comparisons, particularly in Europe. And I think anybody who buys organic really should learn from you what you've published in this book. And as we wrap up, I'd like you to take us to Bolivia and introduce us to Pedro Carayuri and the important message, not about organic farming, that he imparted to you and your readers.
Yeah, I had quite an adventure tracking him down. The journalism for that really was fascinating. And by the time I finished a 7-hour trek in a 4-wheel drive truck over dirt roads to get to him out in the Chaco, that arid region where Paraguay, Brazil, and Bolivia come together. It was the middle of the night, and we had called ahead, and he was waiting by the light of his one propane-fueled lamp there at his outside kitchen with the dirt floor, and he welcomed me warmly with some curiosity as to why this gringo was coming down here and wanted to talk about beans. And I told him what the project was all about, and I had come prepared. One of the oddities of all of this, Peter, is the globalization aspect, and I'm here talking to you from the Willamette Valley, and we grow black beans here, and yet we're importing them from 5,000-6,000 miles away. So I had brought from an organic farm that I visited just south of Corvallis a bag of beans and gave them to him as an opening present, and he was cordial while he was skeptical. And we talked about his farm and the minimal nature of his existence. He and a bunch of neighbors share one tractor, and And as I said, the kitchen is outdoors. It's a dirt floor. His housing is perfunctory. Wonderful, nice fellow. And I said to him, this is kind of one of these throwaway questions where I was looking for some sort of platitude. And I said, what's the message that you have for these neighbors of mine up in Oregon who are eating your beans? And I expected him to say something like, well, I hope they enjoy my beans. I work very hard at growing them in an organic manner. And they are the best quality that we produce here in Bolivia. That's the answer I expected. And he looked at me and he said, you tell those people up there who are eating my beans how we live down here. You tell them that we don't have any potable water. You tell them that we don't have any electricity. You tell them about the dirt road that you took to get here and how difficult transportation is here. You tell them that we only have one tractor. You tell them that we need help from them, not just them buying our beans. Then he looked at me and he said, and if you want to really know the story, don't just come in here tonight. Stay here for a year and look at the entire life cycle of these beans, this farm, and me and my family. I'm telling you, that was quite the education there in that summing up that he gave me. Very gracious. He gave me a big warm handshake and thanked me for coming and welcomed me to come back. But this was an astute international player who knew exactly how out of balance the system is.
And it's touching that he accepted the black beans that you brought him from the Sunbow Farm in Corvallis and promised to plant them in Bolivia. And I think that is an interesting exchange as well.
It was a sweet, sweet moment.
And Peter, I think this is, I really appreciate that touch to your reporting, because I do think that, organic consumers in the first world need to think carefully about how their dollars are used. And, you know, I love going to Trader Joe's. I like to try a lot of their different fairly exotic products, some that are sourced from other parts of the world. But we become part of a machine that we're oblivious to that grinds the producers in third world countries to deliver the highest quality at the lowest possible price. And this is one of the negative factors of the market power that Walmart has, because they force producers to deliver to a price point. And that can be, dangerous. And the ripple effect of that on the producer economy is something that we rarely give a single thought to, much less a second thought.
And if we just want to be selfish, we can consider the bag of berries that's in our freezer here in Oregon that came from Costco. A friend of ours went to Costco and asked if we wanted anything, and this was one of the items that she brought back. It's a bag of berries. That's also perverse, because Oregon, as your listeners probably know, is known for its berries. It's a bag of frozen berries. It's marked organic, and it says product of Serbia and Argentina. And so just in terms of what you're putting into your gut, you can't trace those two, because they're commingled. So if you were to go back to the source somehow and you found that the berries were no good in Serbia, but they were fine in Argentina, you've got mixed berries there in the bag. The system is out of control, even while the fleets of Brinks trucks are taking the cash from us organic consumers to the bank.
We've been talking with Peter Laufer. His name is spelled L-A-U-F-E-R. You can find out more about his other books at peterlaufer.com. He's written many and was most recently a guest on this program last year to talk about his fascinating book called The Elusive State of Jefferson. And the book we've been discussing today, Organic, A Journalist's Quest to Discover the Truth Behind Food Labeling, is out in hardcover from Lions Press. Peter Laufer, it's always a pleasure.
As it is for me, Peter. I very much appreciate the time and enjoy it.
Well, partner, you look carefully when you see those products marked organic, will you?
Happy trails to you. until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.